B2. Number 25A.
Kennedy was one of her nearest students at the beginning. Then he turned away to mesmerism. And now, from that point on, everything that went wrong in Mrs. Eddy's life, she put down to the malpractice and malicious malpractice of his student Kennedy. Everything that went wrong with her in her house and everything, Kennedy was to blame. Now you remember how it came to that point that when once her son came somewhere from the West or Middle West where they still had a good cult in, or what you call?
Cult 45.
With him, the story runs that he got so fed up by hearing that everything that went wrong was to blame on Kennedy that he just went into Kennedy's office and threw his coat and said, "Now, look here, finish that job, you see." And threatened him. I don't know if that story is true, but you read it from time to time in one of these. Say, well, just to give, if it's true or not, it gives somehow the atmosphere of that time, of that malicious animal magnetism. She calls the malpractitioner just demonologist, malicious mesmerist. And it's interesting to see what she says there about the modus operandi of mesmerism. I give it here, I recount them here quickly what she says there, just to impart the general atmosphere, because afterwards we just can get rid of it again. She says, "What is that which animates the mental practitioner?" And Josie said, "It is his tyranny, the stolid moral sense, the great want of spiritual, a great want of spiritual sentiment, restless ambition and envy, desire to subjugate, despotic will, carefully veiling his character through secretiveness, a dark and designing plotter. He intends to do with mental power whatever he chooses to do. Malpractice becomes a secret passion. With willpower removes one disease which is succeeded by a more malignant one. It makes one a moral leper." Can you see, it's quite a gruesome story. She says, "What can a malpractitioner achieve?" She says, "It makes people who have been healed relapse into sickness and kills them." Quite a good killer, huh? "It makes out of friends enemies. It makes people feel uncomfortable in the atmosphere of a good metaphysician. They get restless. It makes people believe that metaphysics makes sick. Turns it right over, you see. It attacks the surroundings and the relatives if it does not succeed in attacking directly. If malpractice cannot hit at the person directly, it just kills everything around it. Says it is treating mentally and mesmerically to lure the victim into his own downfall, so that the victim trusts in the malpractitioner, the malpractitioner does nothing else but to bring him to a downfall. It disrupts home life, renders sick and kills, alienates affection between husbands and wife, makes people render false witness through the entire control. She says it makes people turn from those who would benefit them, abuse their benefactors. It makes people swear the opposite facts. It makes rapid changes in morals. It pursues the cause of Christian Science to exterminate it." Quite a story, quite a story. Then she asks herself, what are the indications of mental malpractice? How can we see that mental malpractice is at work? She says, it has no outward signs, but its tendency is to sour the disposition, to occasion great fear of disease, dread, and discouragement, to cause a relapse of former disease, to produce new ones, to create dislikes or indifference to friends, to produce suffering in the head. Well, it tries to produce hatred, to make the victim believe that someone else is practicing him. It can make mortals believe a lie. It can tell one to perform certain acts at stated times. You know how it went so far, she recounts there that experience, that it went so far, that malpractice, that they hired somebody who was a prisoner, in the prison, and stated that Dr. Eddy had killed somebody. And only after a long time he could prove that it was wrong, and that he was made mentally to state completely wrong facts to destroy Dr. Eddy, so as to destroy Mrs. Eddy. And so she gives a complete, very detailed expose of the alleged murder of Dr. Eddy. That whole, what she calls a diabolic conspiracy, full of lies and fraud. So, can you see the tone now in this third edition? The counterfeit of soul sense which blesses, which is sinless, is being brought out through this mental malpractice. Then she says that she discovered new facts in 1880, in the summer 1880, namely that she never fully fathomed the intrigues of malicious malpractice until summer 1880. She recognized now the fact, and this is a statement, that the facts of immortal mind, capitalized, are more than equal to meet the fables of mortal mind. Here now, for the first time, you see, she went right through the point of soul, where mind is the soul of all. You see, where she could see that the divine mind equals soul. That in the moment we can define mind as divine mind, then in that divine mind we have the protection. And there, in that consciousness of the divine mind, really, we are secure. There we cannot be touched by malicious animal magnetism. It is said that this edition and the succeeding, the fourth and fifth edition, was so quickly sold out because this chapter on demonology just attracted everybody. It was, you know, it was a real good seller, that story. All right. Now we come to the sixth edition in 1883. Here she changed again, and the whole chapter has now the touch of principle, of impersonality. The title of the chapter is still Demonology, but she reduced it from 46 pages to 12 pages. What she left out was that whole criminal stories. She left it right out. Was no more one name mentioned in it. Before, she mentioned them all, you know, Kennedy and all those people who were in trouble there. And now she put out the whole thing, the whole personal thing. And the accent is now on impersonalizing animal magnetism. So here, no names are anymore given. That whole court case about Dr. Eddy is no more in it. And she just brings out that animal magnetism is an impersonal belief. So she takes it away from the malpractitioner and from people and so on, and makes it a general belief. Great step forward, you know. If I looked around, you see, and what I have to hear from the people who come to me and talk to me in various countries and places and so on, they come and say, well, you know, I suffer under the malpractice of Mr. or Mrs. So-and-so. See, which shows that those stories which went on up to the third revision are still that which governs the thought of today. After 100 years, you see, they have not risen out of that third revision to the fourth revision of seeing that animal magnetism and malpractice is something completely personal, that it has nothing to do with people. That finally we should get to the point where we leave that childish thing, that we feel that so-and-so is malpracticing us. Usually people are too busy today to have time to malpractice on somebody else. Much too busy. Then, only 3 years later, 1886, she gives out a revised edition, the 16th edition, which has in this chapter the tone of life. The tone of life. The title is now no more demonology, but is now animal magnetism for the first time. I have written here that the accent is on the dragon's warfare against the woman. See, it's now no more a warfare against people, between people. Now it is the warfare between the dragon and the woman. Animagnetism warring with the divine idea. Now she begins to impersonalize the whole thing and sees it is just animal magnetism warring against the new idea. And she shows here that without the knowledge of animal magnetism, error continues and increases. Here is the great period in which between 1886 and 1891 she opened a special department in the journal called Animal Magnetism and invited people to send in their experiences with animal magnetism so as to bring it before the students so that to become aware. At this point she felt the more we bring out and show to the people how animal magnetism works, the more the students will be cautious and will be on the guard and in that way protect themselves against animal magnetism. She feels that if this is not brought out and is left to go on, it will increase and increase and find new ways and new methods of increasing that subtlety of animal magnetism. It is at this period of 1887 that she published an article called Ways That Are Vain, which are today in prose work, Miscellany 210-13, which gives quite a deep analysis of how animal magnetism works. It is a long article, also a bit gruesome, or a lot of it, but also very enlightening to see what is the arguments of animal magnetism. And that article is the only article of that long period which appeared in the journal, which has been taken into prose work and has been preserved really for posterity. But she didn't put it into it. She didn't put that article into prose work. This article was put into prose work later by the directors of the Boston Church. She didn't put it in. Mrs. Eddy left Miscellany to be published after her death, and when they began to publish it, they put in some other articles, and this is one of them. And this is really more than just not being quite loyal or quite obedient. This is much more than that. This has more or less stopped the movement from growing. Because through this article, which still has that gruesome tone of how terrific animal magnetism is, how powerful it can be if it is not checked, and how it will grow, and how it will put friends apart, and husband and wife apart, and so on and so on and so on, has now been taken over into prose work and given to the field, and the field thinks this is what Mrs. Eddy has been teaching about animal magnetism, not knowing that she changed afterwards the whole subject on animal magnetism in the later editions. And so the field as a whole stays there where Mrs. Eddy was in 1887. And still is a threat to the bone of animal magnetism and of malpractice. Whereas Mrs. Eddy grew out of it, as we will see, absolutely out of it, and therefore has given to the whole subject a freedom, a higher view, and a more scientific view. So this, I think, is really the bad side of not being obedient to Mrs. Eddy, that such a thing has been taken. If any harmful letter or any harmful article or poem or so which Mrs. Eddy wrote would have been added in spite of her will, well, that wouldn't have mattered so much. But exactly to take that, which she had overcome afterwards, and put to the field, that whole old stuff, and feed the field with that sense of animal magnetism, this is a crime. This is a real crime. And therefore, there is no wonder that in speaking with the Christian Scientists in the whole, their mentality about the subject on animal magnetism is just still there. Just still there. But it's still there where she has written this thing. Then in 1889 she wrote another article which is in the journal, Malicious Animal Magnetism, which is still in circulation among people but which has not been published. In that article she has said, God has bidden me to uncover this wickedness. Let all scientists aid in this work, first by bringing out in their reports on the practice of healing careful statements on the facts of malicious animal magnetism that are daily passing before their eyes. See, she made more of it than less of it. She made more of it and said, let's know it, make more of it. Though she naturally wanted to analyze it and so on. But the effect of it was that people got afraid of animal magnetism. Instead of seeing through it, they got afraid of it. So finally, in August 1890, she put into the journal a short notice, a card, which had the title, and in this card she says, the discussions of animal magnetism had better be dropped until scientists, no more metaphysicians, until scientists understand clearly how to handle this error. So she dropped it. She could see this is not the right step. Until they are not in danger of dwarfing, you say dwarfing, their growth in love. What it did, those articles, and this article, Ways That Are Vain, is that it dwarfs their growth in love. Everyone is afraid of the other one. No one trusts anymore the other one. Everyone just fears whatever I say, whatever I do will be reported. They are just like that. There is no more a free flow of love. It has done that. That dwarfing of the growth in love by falling into this lamentable practice in their attempts to meet it. The more you're afraid of something, the more you support it and the more you do it yourself. The more you're mesmerized by it and you do it yourself. So she says, only patient, unceasing love to all mankind, love that cannot mistake love's aid, can determine this question on the principle of Christian Science. So instead of showing all that malpractice, she said, we should really put it before the eyes of our students, the love that cannot mistake love's aid. That's the answer for it. And so at this point, she rewrote the chapter on animal magnetism, and in the 50th edition, 1891, she only has 7 pages on animal magnetism. There she dropped all these pages, those passages which had to do with that struggle between the dragon and the woman. All that went out of the text, and all that remained was really a sense, you handle animal magnetism by doing right. This is the thing which you should do, by doing right. Yes, I have written here that the title of the chapter is Animal Magnetism, 7 pages. The text is similar to the final edition. She dropped all those passages referring to the struggle and warfare. The accent is now on doing right, which excludes animal magnetism. Evil is now defined as having no power, no reality, and that it is only a belief. A belief has not one quality of truth. At this point, she brings it right down to a belief. She says, there is no transference of mortal thought and willpower. Think of it. Up to that point, she always wrote as if there were transference, as if the mesmerist can influence silently or audibly evil thoughts into the head, into the consciousness and thought of the patient. Now she says, there is no evil transference. Only as late as that. So finally, she gave that short article in 1899, What Our Leader Says. And that article is in prose work, in Miscellany, written just before Ways That Are Vain, that which should not be in it. And actually, if one reads Miscellany, and it's a new chapter there, a new subtitle, the first thing is What Our Leader Says, and in this chapter she says, beloved Christian Scientists, keep your mind so filled with truth and love that sin, disease and death cannot enter. It is plain that nothing can be added to a mind already full. Good thoughts are an impervious armor. Clad therewith, you are completely shielded from the attacks of error of every sort. This wonderful, clear, transparent statement, you see, that the way to protect oneself from the belief of animal magnetism, which is anyway only a belief, is to fill thought with truth and love. And then when you read on in the prose work, you come to this funny article on Ways That Are Vain, where she drops the whole tone, or where the whole tone is dropped now through this insertion, which shouldn't be there.
Today, I would like to give you a historical review of how the idea of practice developed since the inception of Christian Science Healing. I want to do that in order to give you a perspective where we are from the point of view of Christian Science practice. We have been looking at the structure of being all through the week and have been seeing how thought has evolved and evolved and evolved, and naturally in a similar way the method of practice has evolved too. And it is good to see what are those various stages of practice and method of practice that were used all over or since about 100 years, so that we can much more value what we have today. So Here is a short survey on the method of practice over the last 100 years. Why should I give you such a historical review? In Collectania, I think it is that there is an incident recorded where somebody wrote to Mrs. Eddy and asked Mrs. Eddy if she could give her the name of a good practitioner. And Mrs. Eddy replied that she could not do that, but that in her case she would choose a practitioner who knew something about Christian Science history. Isn't it an interesting answer? And to know something about Christian Science history, and that would be a good practitioner. Now, she didn't mean with this that she knew all the historical data and so on, but that we should know the spiritual history of Christian Science, which meant here the spiritual history of the development of the method of Christian Science healing. So let's go right back into Mrs. Eddy's life and see that really that which molded her to be the discovery of Christian Science healing were more or less two distinct traits of character. One trait of character was that she was very religiously minded, and second, that she had a scientific mind. This religiously mindedness showed itself very early in regard to healing, when we know as a little child she had a great fever, and that through prayer she healed herself from that great fever. Then we know that as a young woman she began to be interested in healing and therefore was investigating in a scientific way, so to say, the medical branch. She was investigating allopathy, you see, found that this didn't give an answer, then investigated very closely homeopathy. And we know from her writings that she was using homeopathy in many, many cases and was healing quite severe cases with homeopathy. The book and prose work, the textbook and prose work, are full of such incidents where she shows that with homeopathic method she could really heal many, many difficult cases. The thought behind it was that where we can see where the whole thing started is that through homeopathy she began to realize that it is not matter that makes somebody sick, nor that it is matter that makes somebody healthy again, but that she was looking for a mental cause of all material effects. So her training in homeopathy was really training her to reduce matter to mentality and being prepared for a more mental way and method of healing. Then again, later, it must have been round about 1854, we hear again of her healing through religious faith. There is that nice incident where a mother brought her child and to Mrs. Eddy. That child had some eye disease, I cannot remember exactly what it was, and very severe. And then she said she took the child in her arm and lifted up her thought and gave the child back healed instantaneously. That was long before she met Quimby. That was even at a time where she herself struggled very, very severely with her own health.
where her own health went down and down, and she was struggling to find a remedy for her own sickness. And we know that she was finally getting into a rather bad state. She went then to that, hydropathic cure, and there she heard about Quimby in Portland. Was it in Portland, Quimby? Is that roundabout here?
Yeah.
Just this Portland here? Oh, yes. So she made every effort to go to Portland, and Quimby treated her, and she got quite a good improvement, though not entirely healed, but just the same, healed to such a point that she could begin again to do work and be active.